It's all limp-wristed leftism. It's amazing that the one good bit of gay culture, the worship of the hyper-masculine, is missing entirely. I'm sure there's some ambitious young seminarian out there at this very moment planning a homily about toxic masculinity with which to impress his rickety old socialist bishop. I wish I were joking, but I'm not. America Magazine has already jumped on that bandwagon, which means the priesthood will shortly follow. The social justice doctrine of toxic masculinity holds, following Dworkin and her descendants, that all men are guilty of something. And widespread miscarriages of justice following, for instance, fake rape claims are somehow therefore tolerable. But here's a question. To whom in the church today does the young heterosexual Catholic athlete or football star aspire? If you can't answer, then I think we have a problem. The makeup of the clergy, by which I don't mean the precise shade of foundation your local Monsignor slaps on before hurling himself at 17-year-olds, well, it doesn't reflect the congregation. It's too gay. We're constantly being told that politicians and actors on television should be more representative, which is the left's code for anything but white. But there's no reason not to praise some degree of representativeness in principle, and especially from religious leaders, which means we need more straight priests. If for no other reason than to correct the glaring deficiency of heterosexuals in the priesthood, the church's ban on gay clergy must stay. Not only must it stay, but it should be enforced. You know, in the name of diversity and representation. Those two words, normally enough, to start a new episcopal initiative. Chapter 5. Make the Vatican Straight Again. If you've made it this far, congratulations, you have a strong stomach. By now you probably have an image in your mind of a gay Catholic mafia secretly pulling the strings at the Vatican, with pedophile priests and other gay predators working overtime to smear their accusers and political opponents. And yeah, that's pretty much what's been happening. Whether it's elderly antiques dealers and librarians cooing over elaborate vestments, arch-conservative British dandies rapturously describing the virtues of the extraordinary form, or sticky fingers at midnight in the seminary, Rome has become a haven for homosexuals, often with depressingly messed up sexual attitudes and appetites. Estimates place the percentage of gay Roman clergy anywhere between 15% and 50%, but it may be higher. An estimate from the 1980s placed the figure at 30%, but it said that only half the clergy maintained celibacy, which is a generous estimation, I think. At the same time, Catholic priests have been found in a number of studies to be particularly well-adjusted, socially responsible, interpersonally sensitive. Men who join the priesthood generally report themselves being happy with their choice. Well, perhaps that's because they have forbidden but satisfying sex lives. They may well have satisfying sex lives in part because they're forbidden, which is a topic for a very different book. But at what cost to the health of the church and to the rest of us comes the priesthood's continuous post-coital bliss? Leon Podolsky writes that perhaps it's the wounded who especially know their need for the healing touch of Jesus. And if he's right about that, maybe it explains the present crisis and maybe also the church's human resources catastrophe. Nothing has more clearly illuminated the Catholic clergy's descent into brutish, dishevelled moral decrepitude than a recent news story about two podgy Chicago priests who were caught noshing one another off in the front seat of a car on a dirty weekend to Miami. The more you delve into this story, as First Things editor Matthew Schmitz did, the worse it seems to get. Schmitz discovered that one of the priests was a graduate of a vocational men's program called Casa Jesus, which brought gay men from Latin America to Chicago. Casa Jesus was shut down over reports of a depraved sexual culture. Journalists discovered that the program director had been in possession of child porn. And another priest linked to Casa Jesus has also been arrested. That was in 2015, also on child porn charges. Schmitz concluded, what we see here is by now a familiar pattern, sexual criminality emerging in a context where non-criminal violations of clerical celibacy have become commonplace. That's another way of saying that if you let one sin in, the rest will follow. And it's a critical observation. It isn't any one sin, let's say homosexual acts, that matter to the general trajectory of the church as much as the toleration of sin in principle and in general. Places where the church looks the other way and tolerates wrongdoing, especially in its own house, are destined to become cesspools of vice, because that's how human beings work. It's the blind eye shown to gay sex that makes room for worse things to grow, especially among gay men who know they will be given a pass and know there will be other gay men to stick up for them should they find themselves in trouble. Monsters, too, like pedophiles, are attracted to places where they know they can get away with murder because everybody's looking the other way. So obviously a homosexual person with depraved tendencies is going to latch on to a profession where illicit forms of gay sexual activity are systematically hushed up. It's like the church has hung a sign outside its door that says pervert wanted for cushy pastoral role, no questions asked. In this book, we've wafted over the worst details of clerical child abuse, but you can read about them if you want, in excruciating, sick-making detail, in another of Leon Podol's books, which is called Sacrilege, Sexual Abuse in the Catholic Church. It's a book so necessarily graphic that the publisher, which originally commissioned it, ultimately declined to publish it. I won't quote from it here because I don't want to put you off. We're only halfway through the story and you must get to the last chapter. But to fully grasp the enormity of the abuses and the monstrousness of those the church has protected, Podol's book is unmatched in its level of detail. When the author sent copies out to his friends and contacts upon publication in 2008, abuse victims wrote to him in their dozens to thank him, but not a single priest dared to acknowledge even the book's existence, presumably for fear of reprisals from their bishops. It's too easy to write the Catholic Church off as morally disordered, as unhealthily obsessed with sex, or simply structurally corrupt and protective of powerful, abusive men. That's what the left does, because they want to equate the wrongdoing of the Catholic clergy with Christianity itself, to imply there's something wrong with the faith, because there's something wrong with these men. But this isn't good enough. Historically, when national governments have persecuted, castrated, and even murdered homosexuals, the church has not only shown them compassion, but provided a route to fruitful life in service of the community as members of the priesthood. There are easier ways of finding fresh meat to satisfy your sexual urges than spending 7 years in penury training to become a Catholic priest. There appears in some societies to be a sort of sweet spot where gay life is stigmatized, but the society is sufficiently Catholic-friendly that gay men who aren't sure of whether or how to live out their full sexual urges instead join the priesthood, and whether or not they do continue to be sexually active, the church protects them and protects them from the state. The priesthood has been a home for sex offenders too, though, and that does include child predators. But it is worth bearing in mind that the difference between priests found guilty of sex with a minor and what we might call full-blown pedophiles. Sometimes gays and pedophiles are the same people. Although gay people are no more likely to be pedophiles, pedophiles are disproportionately gay. You're not supposed to say that because it upsets the gay lobby and politically correct psychologists, but it is perfectly true. In any case, as often as a harrowing story emerges about child rape, there are a dozen or more, perhaps 100 or more, about homosexual encounters in which the lines of consent are slightly less clear and the ages are very different. The majority of offences involving priests concern youths below the age of consent, with 51% between the ages of 11 and 14, and 27% between the ages of 15 and 17, according to the John Jay report. And that was commissioned to determine the nature and scope of sexual abuse by Catholic priests in America between 1950 and 2002. 80% of victims of clerical sexual abuse in a 2011 Philadelphia survey were identified as male teens or young men. And in an earlier study published in 2004, 87.4% were post-pubescent, with only a very small number of allegations related to the abuse of children proper. The exploitation of these older teen boys is vile. It is also illegal. It is an abuse of power. It may amount to rape, but it isn't quite the same thing as pedophilia. When a middle-aged priest is charged with statutory rape for having sex with a boy of 17 who was a willing participant, though he can't give legal consent, we perhaps should not call that child abuse, nor forget that the age of consent can vary even between Western countries and even between American states. What's illegal in a northern state in the US might not be in Germany, or even in a southern state of the Union. And sexual mores do change over time. The Spartans, for instance, regarded gay pederasty as a fact of life, which is something we rightly find unsettling now. But our neat line between gay and straight is also only a recent man-made distinction, and it was only in the 19th century that homosexual began to appear as a definition of sodomitic acts and as a psychiatric phenomenon. Modern psychologists believe that homosexual isn't a natural category of person, it's a sort of construct, which means it can be uninvented. The Church, of course, was hundreds of years ahead of this science, as it always is, by sharply defining the sinful dimension of homosexuality as the act and not the urge. Thus, we can love the sinner, who's powerless to control his desires, but can choose not to indulge. Scripture does not condemn homosexuals as a class of person. It condemns the act of sodomy. The latest research and the Church seem to agree, as do some gay conversion therapists, that a reduced preoccupation with disordered identities and a renewed focus instead on the acts, which are the products of free will given to us by Christ, is more faithful to how human beings actually work internally and therefore is more effective medical and spiritual therapy. Codifying somebody as a gay Christian is theologically and psychologically illiterate, and it presents the subject with a sort of foreclosed identity that can intensify physical cravings, it can complicate his moral journey, it can reduce his complex whole to a single sin, and it can also cut off the road back from a sexuality that might have been formed out of social necessity or in error. A clue to the Catholic Church's prescience on this is in the low rank that sins of the flesh command in the general taxonomy of wickedness, which we mentioned earlier. As ever, the compassionate and wise Benedict XVI got it just right. Writing as Cardinal Ratzinger in 1986, he cautioned against allowing characteristics such as sexual identity to represent the whole of a person, because they distract from the fundamental identity of a person as a creature of God. He wrote, quote, "The human person made in the image and likeness of God can hardly be adequately described by a reductionist reference to his or her sexual orientation. Everyone living on the face of the earth has personal problems and difficulties, but challenges to growth, strength, talents, and gifts as well. Today, the Church provides a badly needed context for the care of the human person when she refuses to consider the person as a heterosexual or a homosexual and insists that every person has a fundamental identity, the creature of God, and by grace, his child and heir to eternal life." End quote. A traditional Christian teleology of sexual identity places marriage and procreation at the heart of everything we do as sexual beings. On this reading, gay men may be forgiven sexual transgressions if they also fulfill their obligations to the succeeding generations in some way. What gay men should probably do is stay away from pastoral roles in the Church and find some arrangement through which they can still have children, provided those children are reared in a stable home environment with both mother and father regularly present. Children should not be raised in same-sex households. Children brought up by same-sex parents fare poorly later in life, with more emotional problems than other children. They're also more likely to turn out gay themselves, despite what left-wing activists claim. The data suggests that under no circumstances should children be abandoned to be raised by lesbians. Lesbian domestic arrangements are routinely overshadowed by the ever-present threat of violence. You'd be better off taking your chances, setting a wicker basket adrift in the Nile and hoping your tot gets plucked out of the water by the daughter of a wealthy family. I've written in the past about why gay men should get back in the closet, somewhat satirically, but a version of the 1950s model, minus the queer bashing, perhaps, might be the best option for pious gay men wrestling with their life choices. Let's face it, it couldn't be any more depressing or unsatisfying than gay pride. The numbers say that the vast majority of abuse cases do not involve young children. Philip Jenkins, professor of history and religious studies at Penn State and the author of Pedophiles and Priests, Anatomy of a Contemporary Crisis, wrote a widely cited article for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette in March 2002 titled The Myth of the Pedophile Priest. Jenkins shared data from the Catholic Archdiocese of Chicago that suggests a dramatically lower incidence of sex offences than many readers might expect, and a huge drop from the heyday of abuse in the 60s, 70s and 80s. Outside that period, between 1965 and 1980, when abuses were at their height, much of the sexual abuse crisis in the Church boiled down to quasi-consensual acts between older homosexuals and a mixture of straight and gay younger men, some of whom didn't feel able to fend off advances at the time or speak about their experiences until much later. Using a generous preponderance of the evidence standard, data from Chicago suggests that out of 2,200 ordained individuals, only 40, or 1.8%, were probably guilty of misconduct with minors at some point in their careers. And out of that 2,200 priests in Chicago, there was only one pedophile. There's reason to suppose that the United States may be an aberration when it comes to clerical sexual abuse. Data cited by Cardinal Vincent Nicholls suggests a sex offender rate of just 0.4% among priests in England and Wales, a percentage that's accepted even by the Church's critics. On the other hand, a full 7% of Australia's priests are said to have abused children. But not even priests themselves can agree on the causes of sex scandals in the church. In a 2002 survey, priests who describe themselves as left-leaning said the key factor in the child abuse crisis is the requirement that priests be celibate, while self-described conservatives blamed it on homosexuals in the clergy. Clearly, the conservatives are right. Psychologists will say that neither is relevant to the sexual abuse of children. Only a third of respondents, by the way, claim they do not waver from the vow of celibacy. The church has never asked priests about their sexual orientation, although the official position is that homosexuals are barred from applying to become priests. That is a prescription that ought to stay. Barred might be a bit of a strong word, since every time the position is clarified by the church, there follows, in the words of one journalist, a plethora of articles, including some in L'Osservatore Romano, the Vatican daily newspaper, in which the writers fall all over themselves to make sure we understand that there must be undoubtedly frequent exceptions to every rule. What becomes clear when you look at who is abusing whom is that this isn't primarily a pedophile problem. It's a gay problem. And incidentally, churches that ordain priestesses have experienced a similar phenomenon, only with lesbians, which suggests that the male-on-male dimension to the Catholic crisis may at least in part be a function of male-only clergy, and that the most instructive dimension of this crisis is indeed its homosexual nature. If the Catholic Church were to give in to what the left wants and start ordaining women and setting aside celibacy, the result would be more abuse, not less. As Jeff Myrus of CatholicCulture.org writes, most Catholics would rather not have to think and speak endlessly about this stuff, but the composition of their clergy leaves them with little choice. Given that the majority of encounters we're concerned with occur between priests and younger men, but not children, we should focus not so much on what attracts perverts to the Catholic Church, as we should a more readily explicable and obvious phenomenon, why the Church is so gay. Straight Catholics have been complaining for decades about tight-knit circles of gay priests who cover for one another and punish anyone who calls out their misdeeds. Heterosexual whistleblowers are sometimes even fired by their gay superiors. This almost certainly has implications for the abuse crisis, in which powerful homosexual bishops hold the threat of termination above young seminarians' heads, which is only the second worst thing they like to dangle in that position. There are, by the way, and I should stress this is just my own observation, quite distinctively politically different types of homosexuals in the Catholic Church. Some are the conservatives I alluded to earlier, who at least offer their charges a good glass of red wine and perhaps an educational evening at the opera before an awkward encounter back at the rectory. As I used to say about Father Michael, at least he took a girl out for dinner first. These conservatives tend, in my experience, to fall into the category of inexperienced quiet loner or repressed, sexually bashful older gentlemen. But then there are the more cliquey left-wingers, the ruddy-faced, grinning, corpulent ones, who run circles around their conservative counterparts in both technique and volume. These men are more likely to have well-connected friends. They're more likely to seek power in the church hierarchy that will protect them. They're the Weinsteins and the McCarricks of the church world, more physically demanding and abusive, more sociopathic, more psychiatrically disturbed, and they always seem to be on the way back from lunch with some high-ranking bishop or on the way to an influential committee. And for all these reasons and many more, they're a lot more dangerous. For some reason, the priests who are doing the most damage are the ones who talk the least about God, the least about the Bible, and the most about climate change. I can't tell you why that is. What should concern us most about the Lavender Mafia isn't the fact that these priests are gay, it's that they use homosexual acts as an excuse, as an outlet, and as a way to maintain power, and that they seem to be fundamentally immoral people. McCarrick and others like him are lawless men who think nothing of violating norms and rules if they can get away with it. They may well also be godless, even if they believe they believe. There's some awareness within the church that the dilution of doctrine might be at the root of its present crisis. Cardinal Müller, who holds the same top job at the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith as Joseph Ratzinger once did, recently gave a strongly worded speech in Rome, insisting that a breakdown in respect for church teaching and rejection of the truth is what has lubricated the way for depravity and scandal, and not clericalism, the favoured nebulous excuse from Team Francis for moral failures. Evil acts, says Müller, must be condemned by ecclesiastical authority, the perpetrators punished according to law, with the idea that Christian dogma is no longer the ground and criterion of morality and pastoral care. A Christological heresy comes into view. The Lavender Mafia's homosexuality is related to what the church regards as immorality, but probably only in the sense that gay people are more likely to have high IQ, and thus belong to a category of people who habitually violate societal and evolutionary norms. The precise relationship is not yet known, but studies consistently show a correlation between gayness and high intelligence. Theodore McCarrick speaks 5 languages, for instance. Generally, researchers in the area believe that homosexual tendencies and intelligence are to some degree, and perhaps mostly, inherited, though there's some reason to believe that lesbianism may operate differently. Behavioral scientists have suggested that high IQ individuals, transcending their natural programming, may perform an evolutionary function. This could explain the disproportionate numbers of homosexuals in the arts and other fields where breaking taboos is an advantage. Upbringing is critical to how these genetic predispositions express themselves. McCarrick, for instance, grew up without a male role model after his father died when he was 3 years old. But whether these experimenters and creative thinkers are the people we want in charge of religious institutions is highly questionable. High intelligence is a handicap in many professions. We don't need our bishops to be freewheeling intellectuals, anxious to experiment with their sexuality and with the liturgy. We need them to be reliable moral compasses. We don't need DMV employees or TSA screeners running churches, just imagine sitting through their homilies, but nor do we need literary theorists or theoretical physicists. It seems to me that the preponderance of homosexuals in the clergy is the result of faulty admissions criteria. The church has been testing for intelligence, scholarliness, and cultural sophistication, welcoming all the eccentricity and peculiarity that goes with what is essentially now an academic body. This won't shock many of you, but faculty members in American universities are disproportionately likely to be gay, even controlling for political orientation. Scoring seminary applicants highly for intelligence and sensitivity to art and culture is guaranteed to produce a gay cohort. Other qualities make for better bishops, and other qualities should be reprioritized. The homosexualization of the priesthood and the wider church is one manifestation of a general weakening of religious institutions and of the faith generally, in part thanks to the communist infections of the 1930s and thereafter, and also thanks to the leftward drift of all major institutions in the West over the past century. But there's a more practical reason gays in particular didn't swarm the priesthood before 1900. Before that, joining the clergy was no joke. Old-school Jesuit and Franciscan missionaries could expect to be in constant physical pain. Bishops, too, at the time were badasses, as a long blog post on the subject of gay priests by Father David Nix in Denver explains, and he says, quote, "Catholicism grows very well in pain and opposition, but by the time John F. Kennedy was president of the United States, Catholics were no longer sidelined, but rather mainstream. Fighting side by side with Protestants in 2 world wars earned us the respect as equals. Catholics went from unpopular and poor in the 19th century to popular and rich after the Second World War. It came to be that if you want to live in a $1 million rectory just for offering one mass a day, but you don't want to tell your mother why you don't like women, the Catholic priesthood might be right for you." End quote. As the Padre puts it, with the switch from fringe belief to mainstream religion, Catholicism became a more convenient lifestyle choice for gays who might not want to hurl themselves into feats of physical endurance. I don't know for sure, but I'm willing to bet the vast majority of gay priests are receivers. I mean, they take it in the ass. And they're therefore more fragile in constitution. They're the camp gays. Don't underestimate the effect of that on the church as a whole. I certainly can't imagine many of today's frocked and perfumed monsignors signing up to get stung by scorpions on the walk from central Mexico to southern California, as St. Junipero Serra did. For too many priests and too many female churchgoers, I suspect, religion has become a means of escape from the harsh realities of life, rather than a demanding, but ultimately rewarding, roadmap to spiritual liberation. At the core, then, of Team Francis's immorality is not their sexual preference or even a crisis of faith, although both of those things clearly obtain. Rather, the Lavender Mafia are just scheming, smart people who think the rules don't apply to them. And they've found a home with the occasionally naive foot soldiers of the Catholic Church, from whose centres of power they run amok. so they resemble the corrupt, hypocritical regimes that dominate Hollywood, the academy, and the media, all, not coincidentally, godless places where cultural Marxism rules supreme. In a sense, then, the clerical abuse crisis in the Catholic Church is just another example of a rich, well-insulated, left-wing elite establishment consumed by coitus, corruption, and cover-up. These people appear not to believe in very much at all except the pursuit of power and, perhaps secondarily, the pursuit of boys. It's no consequence that the media run cover for Francis and Co. when so many of its own people use precisely the same mechanisms of control. This is why conservatives sniffing a rat but not fully understanding the architecture of the media academy Hollywood religion conglomerate talk vaguely but angrily about left-wing gay mafias running the show and protecting each other. It's true. These claims are sneered out by the mainstream, but they're right more often than they're wrong. Theodore McCarrick doesn't care much for the tenets of his faith if his words and actions are anything to go by. But there is one religion he's fond of, which suggests that he doesn't have much regard for homosexual rights either. Can you guess which one? In 2015, McCarrick addressed the Islamic Society of North America's Interfaith Conference in Virginia, calling the organization an extraordinary instrument of understanding, instrument of cooperation, and instrument of beauty. In case that name doesn't ring a bell, ISNA was an unindicted co-conspirator in 2007's landmark terror finance trial, thanks to its deep links to the Muslim Brotherhood and the terrorist group Hamas. McCarrick unctuously praised ISNA's leaders as so much a part of America, and he described the Muslim community, the Ummah, as growing. He described ISNA as very important to me, telling listeners that the things that you believe are very beautiful. The guffaws from ISNA members after McCarrick left the building have sadly not been preserved for us. But McCarrick was a regular flatterer of some of the most militant elements of Islam. He supported Georgetown University's Saudi-funded Center for Muslim Christian Understanding, which sounds good, but it was there that he mingled with Islamic apologists and promoted Islamic propaganda films. McCarrick was then affiliated with several projects led by Sheikh Abdullah bin Baya, who has praised jihadists fighting Israel and the United States. McCarrick described bin Baya as the prophet of light and the prophet of reason. McCarrick isn't the only one. Much of the Catholic hierarchy has pandered to Islam, and with the exception of Benedict XVI, even popes have, for some generations now, appealed to Muslims for no discernible reason, while at the same time Muslims persecute and murder Christians all over the Middle East. They murder gay twos, of course, which ought to trouble the Catholic clergy more than it does. Back in 1999, John Paul II was proudly photographed kissing a Quran, a book that denies Christ. The response from many Catholics was, why? Has any Muslim ever kissed a crucifix? If Catholic bishops spent as much time talking about sin as they do working out how to pointlessly reach out to Muslims, their congregations would grow fivefold. Chapter 6. Make way for the irreligious right. What happens if we don't save the Catholic Church and Christianity as a whole begins to wither and to die? Well, for one thing, the identity politics that plagues modern life will never be beaten. The loss of religion in public life is what opened up the space for all these race hucksters and feminist dingbats in the first place. We're familiar with the ugly, divisive strategies deployed by the political left and the effect of splitting us all up into distinct groups, gays, blacks, women, and all the rest of it. It isn't making for a very happy or harmonious polity. But as bad as the left's race-baiting and bullying of Christian bakers and endless hand-wringing can be, just imagine what will happen when the right finally gives in, setting aside faith and universal moral principles and committing itself to the same ugly identity-based conflicts. Is there a better way to win? Well, yes, but doubling down on a secularized technocratic quests for truth and leaning on classical liberal ideals aren't going to be enough to reverse the damage done to the West by cultural Marxism and by the progressive left. Jonathan Haidt, co-author of a new book, The Coddling of the American Mind, and leader of the Heterodox Academy, is regarded as something of a hero in the pushback against political correctness on campuses, but as Aaron Seberium notes in his review of that book for the American Interest, Haidt isn't a threat to the left, because he fundamentally misunderstands its nature, and he's failed to grasp the psychological implications of safe spaces and trigger warnings, which are a manifestation of spiritual dissatisfaction and not imperial ambition. That's to say, in other words, student insanity isn't a product of psychiatric dysfunction or fragility, but rather the product of ideology that's been brewing on campuses for decades. You can't fix that problem without purging the poisonous ideas. Identifying God-hating cultural Marxism as such and beating it to a bloody pulp is the only way. Without a commitment to universal truths, value-neutral classical liberalism just perpetuates the moral vacuum in which PC culture arose in the first place. Likewise, the church's current crisis is theological. Too many of its bishops appear not to believe in God, or are at least relaxed about setting aside church doctrine when it suits them. Haidt and his co-author Greg Lukianoff repeatedly object to left-wing absurdities as harmful to students, but they don't explain why the left is wrong, which they can't do without committing themselves to moral principles that they think are going to alienate the non-existent reasonable middle they seek to persuade. As Bridget Gabriel once so memorably explained, the peaceful majority are irrelevant. Conflicts for the souls of civilizations are not won by gently taking the majority with you. They're won by pulverizing the extremes of your opposition into submission with relentless, aggressive public displays of ritual humiliation and by factual rebuttal. Haidt is probably capable of this, but like everyone else claiming to lead the charge on campuses these days, he foolishly refuses to deploy the only strategies with any hope of success against the cultural left. He and his heterodox academy are well-meaning, but completely ineffective. It will be left to the faithful to take up arms instead, and I would much prefer to see this battle played out in speeches and books, and not on the streets. But not everybody shares my restraint. Conservatives, and especially Christians, do seem to have a natural aversion to political violence, which explains why there is such little right-wing violence despite decades of gruesome provocation and, of course, outright violent attacks from Soros-funded groups like Refuse Fascism and groups like Antifa, which have been identified by several agencies as domestic terrorists. Up until now, violent racism on the right in America has been restricted to a small, unpleasant minority calling themselves the alt-right, who've been endlessly covered by the media and hyped up into this scary rising tide, but who in reality comprise a few thousand misguided nitwits. What happens, though, when the right finally concedes? What happens when the mainstream right capitulates to the left's constant demands to treat race and gender as the preeminent defining characteristics of the self? Well, there's a pretty simple answer to that. Race war. And the whites will probably win. There are already groups of men out there in America preparing for just this kind of conflict, such as the Wolves of Vinland, a Norse neo-pagan men's society based in Lynchburg, Virginia. But there are still those of us who believe it would be better to avoid the conflict, if we can. The Wolves of Vinland resemble a biker gang, except that its well-groomed muscular members draw their iconography from Norse mythology and luxuriate in white power and white nationalist philosophy. The wolves spend their weekends hunting, cooking, and eating their spoils and wrestling one another, which admittedly sounds really very titillating. But the world the wolves want to build is not one that this gay, interracially married author wants to live in. Should you happen upon their rippling torsos on a long walk through the Virginia woodland, I recommend not pointing out to these Norse fetishists that the Viking phenomenon might in fact, at least in part, have been a product of the Islamic Caliphate's need for slaves. Many Vikings in the East were slavers for Muslim overlords, and they only stopped selling their fellow man when, you guessed it, they converted to Christianity. Ever wondered why progressive culture admires the brutal Vikings, glamorizing them in Vikings, True Blood, and The Last Kingdom, but demonizes the chaste crusaders as lepers, crooks, and thieves? If you've seen Kingdom of Heaven and you're wondering why Christians get such a raw deal in it, well, the Vikings were pagans and the Crusaders weren't. This is also the root of the valorization of the Norse in Marvel's Avengers and the Thor movies. You should probably also avoid quoting, should you happen upon the wolves, from New York priest and radio host Father Rutler, unless you can render it in runes for them on a tree and then quickly run away. He says, "The increase in brutishness in our society parallels a decline in manly virtue." Enough realize this to have started groups that hold conferences and retreats to promote male bonding. But this model is a neurotic imitation of some Ostrogoth out in the woods making loud sounds with his body. The noble man must arise again, the manly father of the household and the manly priest at the altar, for masculinity is a sacramental, of the paternity of grace. End quote. It's not just kooky masculinity cults in heavily forested Washington DC adjacent states that spring up when you remove God from conservative politics. Take Richard Spencer, a white nationalist upon whom the left-wing press has lavished praise, describing him as dapper and charismatic. Absurdly, Spencer and I are often compared to one another, either through cluelessness or malevolence, but we could not be more different in basic philosophical outlook, to say nothing of his gauche dress sense and droopy bitch tits. Among the many deep ideological differences I have with Spencer, perhaps the greatest, greater even than our disagreement on race, is the fact that he's an atheist, and therefore pro-abortion. Now, revoltingly, Spencer says that one reason he's pro-abortion is that terminations are disproportionately performed on black babies. I'd normally laugh at the sheer grotesqueness of such a statement, which should appeal to my twisted sense of humour, but you know, it's the strangest thing. Abortion's the one subject on which even Marlianopoulos is reflexively serious. I have to remind myself it's okay to crack jokes about it. If there's one thing in the world that I am genuinely offended by, and that's a big if, it might be the left rebranding the murder of the innocent unborn as a choice that a woman can make about her quote-unquote reproductive rights. I find that viscerally upsetting, and for all my insight into the millennial social justice warrior's unique pathology, this is one corner of the left-wing mind that I don't think I will ever fully comprehend. Perhaps that's my Catholic upbringing at work. Abortion and infanticide were approved of even by noble pagans like Aristotle. Banning them, of course, was one of the first things about the Catholic Church that really shocked the world. The only young organization I've come across that gets the balance almost right is Gavin McInnes's Boisterous and Defiant Proud Boys, of which I am a member. Attendees at Proud Boy meetups, a mixture of ethnicities and sexual orientations, are united by their fondness for the unapologetic candor of Donald Trump, their hatred of feminism and political correctness, and their horror at the systematic undermining of the Western world by its own corrupted institutions. One of the Fraternal Society's mottos is, "I refuse to apologize for creating the modern world." Members of the Proud Boys describe themselves as Western chauvinists. This, at last, is a step in the right direction. And there are Christian members in leadership positions too, such as Rufio Panman, famously caught on camera socking it to an Antifa protester. But while explicitly non-racist, in general the group and its members do not prioritize faith over, let's say, capitalism or democracy, which leaves space for another Christian brotherhood that can deliver on a religious revival, a specifically religious revival, because that's the only plausible path to victory over the progressive left. Naturally, because they represent a powerful counterweight and an equally powerful disincentive to the progressive left's violent foot soldiers of Antifa, the Proud Boys are smeared by the media as far right, which appears in 2018 to mean agrees with the US Constitution. The left in America is famously and proudly godless, but do they really want an irreligious right? The left has produced no effective antidote to Richard Spencer. He has not been humiliated in debate or driven from the dialogue. In fact, the left has fluffed him up as evidence of an outpouring of white nationalism. Meanwhile, no platforming me because they consider a gifted and persuasive center-right personality a lot more threatening. America's showing itself depressingly incapable of resisting identity politics because social justice has so deftly maneuvered itself into the space formerly occupied by God. A survey conducted by the Cato Institute showed that more religious Trump voters cared less about their skin color, while a quarter of those voters who had never been to a church in their lives described their whiteness as a very important component of their identity. Among regular churchgoers, the figure was just 9%, which suggests that white church-going Republicans might be the least racially motivated voters in the country. But this won't last forever. It feels like a given in 2018 that good works are done by the state or by left-wing campaigners and journalism, the academy, or the entertainment business. And certainly, these are the people who crow most loudly about their own moral virtue. But this wasn't always so. Dorothy Day, whose political activism began in women's suffrage and who later became the 20th century's best-known left-of-centre Catholic, hated government welfare programs and railed against statism. She also, just to further warm readers to her, questioned America's endless foreign military entanglements. The left is on the verge of squandering its moral authority with the public, perhaps that's putting it mildly, after giving in to its own crazy fringe. By actively preaching communism, as the New York-based journalists at social justice blog Splinter do every day, overly accommodating the race baiters of Black Lives Matter, and joining in the public ritual humiliation of Christian business owners, the media have alienated half the public already. Their sheer stupidity and cruelty, such as in the recent Brett Kavanaugh debacle, are about to alienate the rest within another decade. Already, sensible people on both sides of the political divide pay no attention to the journalists pontificating about race, especially those who've conjured up the imaginary boogeyman of white supremacy, which only exists to the extent that the left itself has created it. The answer to all this is God. The power of fear-based public shaming is coming to an end, as the Trump election demonstrates, and ever more Americans are defiantly standing up for what they know to be a superior form of social organization to the oppressive cultural Marxism of the left. Capitalist Christian democracy. That's the best thing we've come up with. The best way we have yet devised to organize large groups of human beings to live together in relative harmony. Which is why I like to tell my college audiences that America, with its historically enthusiastic embrace of capitalism, of Christianity, and of democracy, is the greatest country in the history of human civilization. What few on the political right have grasped is that the most important concept in this trifecta isn't capitalism or even democracy. It's Christianity. Conservative commentators like The Times' Ross Douthat do not appear to have much faith in the power of Christ to recover from Christianity's apparent decline in the West and its current scandals. But what actually happens when the political right finally says okay to the left's provocations? Well, as someone who's reported on the far right in America and been blackballed by the journalistic establishment for daring to give the alt-right even a fair hearing, trust me when I say the results will not be pretty. With religion driven from the public square, race is set to become the prime motivating force behind political action for the right now as well as the left. And what will the newly race-conscious, mostly white, heavily armed, routinely censored conservative base think of the media's constant and unfathomably stupid white bashing? Well, they'll view it, of course, as an assault on their identity, requiring a forceful and violent response. Now, the very first shoots of this are showing themselves, and progressives who say the election of Donald Trump was a sort of cry of anguish from white America, well, they're not entirely wrong. But the left is uncharacteristically coy about who created such a relentlessly hostile atmosphere for ordinary, God-fearing, white working-class Americans that they took the drastic step of electing a ridiculous reality TV star to the country's highest office. Yet the Trump presidency is nothing compared to what's coming. If the left can't break its addiction to mocking straight white males, it's going to get ugly. If the reputation and practice of Christianity in the West can't be restored, along with a healthier regard for the masculine virtues, America is at risk of sliding into pre-medieval tribalism. You can't expect innocent, working-class, straight white men who are told from birth that the value of a person is rooted in his skin colour, sexuality and gender, and that everyone should be extremely and very loudly proud of things they had no control over, like the colour of their skin and their sexual orientation, unless they're straight, white and male. And in that case, you're a cancer to society and you deserve to be punished and humiliated, even though you didn't do anything wrong. If this keeps up, sooner or later, the progressive left really might start the kind of armed white pride movement they like to pretend prowls the streets already. Remove God from the conversation and you don't magically gift society with a public square that operates on elevated enlightenment principles of reason, logic, and nice manners. No, all you do is make room for evil to take its place, whether it's race war, gender animosity, obsessions with gay and transgender rights, or bizarre preoccupations with the civil rights of illegal immigrants, the most unhinged version of Marxism to express itself in the culture thus far. Whatever it is, something worse comes along to take its place. Unlike religion, which makes people healthier, happier, and more productive, these alternative routes to redemption leave individuals miserable and societies scarred by wars fought over imaginary grievances. This could all have been avoided in America if the right had put up more of a fight when the left ridiculed and bullied Christianity out of popular culture. Maybe Catholics can lead the way in setting it right. It's a wonder to me that the response from Christian America to the indignities showered upon it by smug liberals has been so mild. Trump is the least that these coastal left-wingers deserve after two generations of race-baiting and God-bashing. But responding to victimhood and special pleading with yet more identity politics isn't the answer. Instead, nothing short of a full religious revival is required throughout the Western world if we're going to avoid civil war. If you're reading this book, you might be one of the people who could help kick it off. And that's why it's so crucial we protect or restore the institutions that bind us together, the most important of which is the church. There's an old anecdote whose original teller escapes me, and it's something like, if you were on the way home late at night and you heard footsteps behind you, would you be more or less concerned if you knew they belonged to someone coming from Bible study? Now, you don't have to be a Catholic or even a Christian to see that Judeo-Christian societies are fairer, happier, healthier, and more tolerant than others. If you're disabled, female, black, gay, or any other disadvantaged group you care to mention, there's nowhere better to be than in a rich Western liberal democracy whose society is underpinned by Christian principles. Yet the progressive left in America seems determined to tear down everything that's made the West a nice place to live for people who aren't rich, straight, white males. Since 2004, the Institute for Studies of Religion at Baylor University has been producing reports that demonstrate how much safer and more pleasant Western Christian societies are, and which provide evidence for the social and economic value of unfashionable organizations such as the Eagle Scouts. The Institute consciously performs the role for the 20th century, what atheist philosopher Feuerbach unintentionally did in the 19th, which is teaching us the true character and utility of religion as a cohesive force in society and as an agent for social mobility, economic growth, and, most of all, simple human kindness, by demonstrating the specific and unusual greatness of Christian civilizations. The Institute's research proves how much Christianity fosters pro-social behavior, family life, population, this list coming from their website, by the way, economic development and social conflict, and it shows how religious-based rehabilitation programs have vastly better outcomes in prisons, especially for the most serious crimes, including violent offenses. The more you look at the numbers, the more you realize Christianity just works. That's because it satisfies that intense longing in the human soul that can't be fully sated by anything else. That longing, that yearning, can be softened by a profound love, and it can be transformed into something pleasurable, albeit ephemeral, with art and music, but only regular participation in public worship can really nail it for you. Study after study has shown that religious people are less anxious and less depressed than other people. That's my second favorite class of study, shortly behind the studies that consistently show that Republicans are more sexually attractive. The more religious you are, the happier you get, the more time you spend with loved ones, and the more generous you are, according to Pew data. The single biggest factor in determining whether somebody will be content with his life is whether he regularly participates in public worship. That's why progressive social justice warriors love public shaming and Twitter mobs, because it's their version of going to church. Modern progressivism shares many functions and rituals with organized religion, which is what makes it so powerful, but also so dangerous. It capitalizes on the innate human need for a higher power or greater purpose. This social justice version of mass is a destructive caricature of the real thing, but it does make you feel better for a while. Because one of the most powerful psychological and emotional benefits of religion is a keener awareness of family and spiritual community. Catholicism makes this emphatic. The family, and not the individual, is the fundamental unit of society. Like capitalism or the British monarchy, to the unbeliever, Christianity might not make a lot of sense on paper. And for sure, it's imperfect, but it simply works better than anything else, and better than some other equally popular religions. Government data from the UK, released in 2016, showed that Muslims were only very marginally happier than atheists, while Christians were significantly more happy than people with no faith. Despite all these advantages, the Catholic Church is experiencing an unprecedented crisis in authority. That same Pew study discovered that 3/4 of Catholics look to their own consciences for a great deal of guidance on difficult moral questions. Just 11% said they look to the Pope. Both left and right, without religion, slide into totalitarianism. The yearning in the human heart to which Christianity speaks has been filled by many evil diversions throughout history. Social justice has filled the void in America, aided by the expulsion of Christianity from public life after decades of ridicule and marginalization by the ascendant cultural left, which began in the 1960s, taking off just about the same time as the abuse started in the church. The Nazis, in their pomp and violence, and the social justice warriors in their righteous Twitter crusades, both reach for that same ecstasy felt by a nun in prayer, or by a churchgoer during Mass, or, in fact, by any one of us in quiet contemplation of a great work of art. C.S. Lewis describes that yearning and where it comes from in his best book, Mere Christianity. He writes, "If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing. If that is so, I must take care, on the one hand, never to despise or to be unthankful for these earthly blessings, and on the other, never to mistake them for the something else of which they are only a kind of copy or echo or mirage. I must keep alive in myself the desire for my true country, which I shall not find till after death. I must never let it get snowed under or turned aside. I must make it the main object of life to press on to that country and to help others do the same." Evelyn Waugh was reaching for the same place in Brideshead Revisited, and passages like the following explain why the novel is so beloved by Catholics. Waugh writes, "Perhaps all our loves are merely hints and symbols, a hill of many invisible crests, doors that open, as in a dream, to reveal only a further stretch of carpet and another door. Perhaps you and I are types, and this sadness which sometimes falls between us springs from disappointment in our search, each straining through and beyond the other, snatching a glimpse now and then of the shadow which turns the corner, always a pace or two ahead of us." Totalitarian ideologies such as Nazism and progressivism offer false hope to those seeking to impose control on a disordered inner world. There is no salvation to be found in getting a journalist fired from an off-color joke, or getting someone run out of public life for being supposedly racist or supposedly sexist because they don't have the same politics as you. Just as there was no redemption to be had at the barrel of a Luger in Berlin in 1945. The dopamine hit from getting Alex Jones banned from every social network must have felt good to CNN media reporter Oliver Darcy, who had been aggressively lobbying Twitter, Google, and Facebook to nuke the radio host from their platforms. But the following morning, Darcy's still miserable, and Darcy's still going to hell. The left's journey to godlessness is almost wholly complete with its embrace of social justice and identity politics, and soon full socialism. They may be lost to us, and we don't yet know what Generation Z, which is intensely skeptical of religion, while at the same time supportive of traditional family structures and dismissive of feminism, has in store for us. But we can start by re-energizing ordinary people about their faith. It is, in fact, the only thing that will save our civilization, never mind our immortal souls. If you don't believe in Christianity, it doesn't matter. It's the only thing that's going to save you anyway. And even if you don't believe in all that, the extraordinary non-material benefits of prayer should be enough to tempt you to at least try it out. What have you got to lose? Chapter 7. The Pope Must Die. Now, ordinarily a humorous reference to a 1991 comedy film starring Robbie Coltrane would not require further explanation, but in these idiotic times, it may be necessary for me to clarify, I'm not seriously calling for the assassination of Pope Francis, and indeed my publisher has insisted on such a clarification, so here it is, good grief. Catholics can be endearingly touchy about criticizing the Pope. As they know, he's only infallible in a technical sense. Certain times, in certain circumstances, in published dogmatic statements that apply to the entire church. In fact, the doctrine of papal infallibility has only been invoked once in reference to Mary's Assumption, and that's since it was first defined by the First Vatican Council in 1870. So when people talk about the Pope being infallible, it's a very unusual and technical thing. However, under ordinary circumstances, it is not on to speak poorly of il Papa. It's considered bad form. Cool, whatever, but these are not ordinary times, are they? Because Francis is certainly not imperfect. impeccable. Impeccable is what most people think is meant by infallible. Impeccable just means you can make mistakes, and Francis can certainly make mistakes. He's also capable of sin, or peccatum. The question is, does he have enough years left in him for all the Hail Marys he's about to be given in the confessional? Typically, when picking their new papal name, popes choose the moniker of a previous pontiff they admire, someone whose work they seek to emulate. Pope Francis picked an entirely new name. This is a move presumably calculated to signal his independence and to lend verisimilitude to descriptions of him as a maverick. But how many future popes are going to pick the name Francis now? When Ross Douthat posed the question in The Atlantic in 2015, will Pope Francis break the church? He wondered aloud whether conservative elements in the church would react badly to the elevation of a pontiff named for the left-leaning reformist Vicar of Christ in that iconic 1979 novel. Douthat lavished praise on Francis, as was the fashion of the age, in awe of the, quote, attention-grabbing breaks with papal protocol, the interventions in global politics, the reopening of moral issues, and the blend of public humility and skillful exploitation of the papal office, end quote. Might Francis, Douthat asked, have the same transformative activist tendencies as that fictional hero? Douthat's story, and others before it, tried to be cautious. Douthat's a rare example of a writer in the public sphere who actually does know a thing or two about Christianity. But the effect of all this unusual praise and close attention was to create an entirely fictional version of Pope Francis, one that existed only in journalists' imaginations. It was that of a cerebral, globalist pontiff, ready to welcome gays openly, satisfy progressive Catholic fantasies, and never miss an opportunity to talk about global inequality and stuff like that. It's not hard to find otherwise sober news stories between 2014 and 2016 piling on the praise, such as a Washington Post story that breathlessly described him as, quote, the freewheeling Argentine pope who loves gays, loves divorcees, and hates income inequality, end quote. But what the facts of Jorge Mario Bergoglio's life show is something a little different. Intellectual sloppiness, ruthless careerism, and a lifelong dedication to ambiguous public statements that hide shifting political positions and an insatiable lust for power. Someone who apparently loathes Donald Trump, Francis shares many of the US president's more grating qualities, including a lack of intellectual seriousness and that lifelong addiction to praise. But unlike his predecessors, Benedict and John Paul, Francis has none of the real estate mogul's affable public persona or his sort of weird counterintuitive likability. As for his dreary sermons on income inequality, this is a pope who freely admits he doesn't have the slightest clue how the global economy actually works. The journalists who hated Benedict XVI weren't sure why. They'd heard he was conservative, so they made every effort to pick sinister-looking photos and generally signal their disapproval. But they thought they were getting a sort of Obama-style hope-and-change pope in Francis, so they instinctively liked Francis more. They didn't realise that he's better described as Clintonian, with a cult of personality that demands absolute obedience and loyalty. Above all else, Francis is a politician content to make some pretty shocking moral compromises to preserve his own power. As reliable a guide to Francis as any of the liturgical positions he may have held prior to being elected pope are the debts he has to European cardinals who got him the job, including some of the most theologically left-wing men in the church, such as England's Cormac Murphy O'Connor and Germany's Walter Kasper. You may remember Walter Kasper as the cardinal who was sent home almost the moment he landed in the UK with the Pope in 2010. That was for referring to Britain as a third world country, apparently a reference to its multiculturalism. Typical of these progressive left-wing elites to be supportive of diversity in principle, but somewhat repulsed by it in practice. Walter Kasper is a snob, a racist, and a liar, but most importantly, he's a hypocrite. Having first denied that he snootily referred to the opinions of African church leaders with the word taboo and dismissed their views as unimportant, this is despite the fact that Africa is undoubtedly the future of the Catholic Church, while in Kasper's native Germany, Catholicism is practically extinct. Walter Kasper had to confess his denial after the release of a tape on which he said exactly what Vatican journalist Edward Penton had reported. The balance of power has shifted in the church dramatically since Francis took office, with minor figures promoted because they have the right progressive outlook on things, and well-respected traditionalists and conservatives humiliatingly, and in at least one case, repeatedly, demoted. The electoral pact through which O'Connor, Casper, Gottfried Daniels and Carl Lehmann formed Team Francis to get Bergoglio elected is explicitly forbidden by the apostolic constitution. That's the rules governing papal elections. But no one moved to stop them. It's possible no one saw it coming. As I've alluded to already, I've been told by editors of Catholic magazines that there's a ferociously conservative traditionalist revival happening among millennial Catholics, and presumably Gen Z beneath them, that's at odds with the burbling emotional incontinence of the elderly left-wingers who currently run the whole shop. One of the most distressing things about the leftmost wing of the College of Cardinals is how little they seem to reflect on God himself. These aging hippies have bought into the modern fad for the all-consuming identity politics. They bought into it hook, line and sinker, hence the church's embrace of hardline left-wing social activism. But the cardinals seem not to realize or to care that the progressive worldview they're pandering to punctures their own spiritual authority. They're buying into Marxism, and Marxism can't tolerate God as a rival power center.